It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show, and welcome to freshly returned from vacation, tanned, rested, and ready, and yes, a little bit of vacation beard on me as well. I'm glad to be with you on a Monday live on the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And yes, I was on vacation for a couple of weeks, and I got plenty of emails from people saying, we don't like it when you go on vacation. Well, you couldn't pay me a nicer compliment than to say something like that. Tina and I were gone for 2 weeks. It is the second, count them, second two-week vacation we've taken in the 25 years that we've been together. And we did something on vacation that we've always wanted to do. And it was entirely clean enough to be able to talk about on the radio. We wanted to do a drive in which we explored America. Now, we've explored plenty of the Northwest. I think we've driven to every corner of Washington, every corner of Idaho, every corner of Oregon at all the different various seasons of the year. I wish I had the time to do that to every state in the 50 states, or if you're an Obama fan, 58 states of America. We have not been able to do that yet, but we were counting up on the way back. There are 11 states in America that we have not visited together. Now, if you count the ones we visited individually, because I've done radio remote broadcasts in a bunch of different states when Tina has not been able to make the trip. But we literally went from sea to shining sea across the entire country in a wheeled vehicle rather than flying over it like the elites of the left coast and the right coast like to do. Now, we did not take up my friend's suggestion, Mark Thiessen, who's a conservative who writes for the Washington Post, believe it or not. He works for Jeff Bezos. Although I just said that and we're on in Seattle on KVI. I hope Mr. Bezos doesn't hear that he has a conservative on the payroll. But Thiessen sent me a map. He said, Lars, do you realize you and Tina could drive across America and never touch a county that voted for Hillary Clinton? You know, voted by the majority for Hillary Clinton, even though, as your liberal friends have been reminding you for the last almost 2 years now, Hillary won the popular vote, which is not how you win presidential elections, but apparently Hillary wasn't aware of that. But we have dreamed for a long time of doing this, getting in a car at one end of the country, drive to the other end of the country, explore every back road that we want to explore along the way, and we did just that. We got on a plane a couple of weeks ago. We flew to Boston because it was the easiest, biggest, most flexible airport, although it is in a crazy state of Massachusetts, and we picked up a rental car. And the rental car company knew that we were going to be picking up there and leaving it somewhere else. And we did. We drove all the way to Bar Harbor, Maine, which is almost on the Canadian border. And then we came back across Maine through New Hampshire and Vermont. By the way, Vermont, lousy roads, lousy politicians, Bernie Sanders country, but nice enough people. And they do have some great maple syrup. They do have that to recommend them. Came through upstate New York, avoided all of the big cities, avoided as much as we could all of the major roads. Came down through New York State, through Pennsylvania. We went through parts of Maryland, parts of West Virginia. We went through Kentucky. We went through Kansas. Remember, these are the flyover states of the United States of America. It was a pleasure. And you know, I'm going to tell you something. I'm not a highway engineer. I'm not an expert in asphalt and concrete and rebar, but I can tell you, you can almost tell, based on the condition of the roads and what's alongside the roads, whether you are in a red state in America or a blue state in America. And let me have you guess, which one do you think has better roads, better highways, more careful maintenance that was going on? In fact, Tina loves the fact that we'd been driving through red states, and we finally cut through a little section of the lower part of Illinois. Now, with just a tiny slice of it, and we decided to stop at a rest area. It was the Skeeter Mountain Rest Area. We pulled in to take a bathroom break, and we walked up, and right on the front of the door to the restroom, it said, "Be aware, we are aware of the brown water problem." It didn't indicate that the state of Illinois was fixing that problem, but they are certainly aware of the problem. We then used the facilities, came out, and Tina noticed that there was a young guy there. There was a sign that said, attendant on duty. And she wondered, she kind of looked in through the door to where this guy was sitting in a small office, a state employee maintaining the order at this rest area, the Skeeter Mountain Rest Area. and she saw a young guy in his 20s. He was wearing an orange safety vest so that he couldn't possibly be mistaken, you know, or hit in the parking lot, something like that. And he had his feet up on the desk, and he was playing on his iPhone. And I'm sure he was making a very nice salary from the state of Illinois. So we went through a lot of America. We saw Kentucky. We saw Kansas. We did a little bit of the Bourbon Trail. We stopped off in strange little towns and not too many big cities. And we did that whole drive. If you want to know how many hours, it's a roughly 48-hour drive if you do it straight through. I wouldn't recommend that. We didn't do that. We took our time. We took the better part of 2 weeks to drive back across America. And I can tell you this, if you didn't know it already, we live in an absolutely beautiful country. There is some wonderful countryside. There are some wonderful big towns and small towns. We met all kinds of different people in different states. And much of what we saw belied all of the stereotypes and the preconditioned ideas that you might have about other parts of America. As I said, we've spent a lot of time around the Northwest. We've driven to every corner of it, to the Olympic Peninsula, to the Canadian border inside of Washington State, north of Spokane into the Potholes area, all the way down in southeastern Oregon to the Alvord Desert. We've gone through virtually every corner of the state of Idaho, and not just for fishing or hunting or those kinds of things, just because we think we live in a beautiful country. And it is an amazing statement. By the time we got done, that rental car had just above 5,000 miles on that car, and we dropped it off. And we had a wonderful time. It is great to see the country you live in and to be able to truly appreciate what we have. The ability to get in a car and cross all those state borders and county borders to go to any city and any place you want to go. You don't have to ask for anybody's permission. And the only thing, well, our driver's licenses were obviously had reciprocity, so we could use them anywhere in America. And no, the concealed carry permit did not have reciprocity everywhere because we don't have that bill through Congress yet. So ask your favorite member of Congress, when are you going to get nationwide reciprocity? President Trump has already said that he plans to sign that bill when it gets to his desk. Anyway, welcome to Monday on the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be back after 2 weeks of break. We spent it the best way we possibly could. And when we got home, we had time to visit with the grandbaby and with the rest of our family and our friends. And now I'm back at work and I'm glad to be here with you. Glad to take your phone calls and your emails, too. And a little bit later, I'm going to ask you, would you be willing to vote for a pagan running for governor of a state? Because we have a pagan candidate for governor of Oregon. You may not know that, and I didn't even know it. I'll have to admit that I'll refer to the reporting of the Portland Tribune and also Jeff Mapes from OPB, because we've got another issue to bring up as well. Some of Kate Brown's allies are using some portions of this program in the ads to attack Newt Bueller and to support Kate Brown by using audio from my program without permission and without attribution. And I don't think much of that practice. We'll get to all of that in your calls as well. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day on the Radio Northwest Network at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, 2 weeks off on vacation, but I'm back behind the mic today to find a new and well-known fan here in the Northwest, Governor Kate Brown. Now, perish the thought, Governor Brown has never agreed to come on this program and do an interview, although she's been invited many times by myself and by my producers. I've even talked to her face-to-face and invited her to come on the program and promised I'd be on my best behavior. But it turns out the governor's allies are using part of an interview I did back in May with Republican gubernatorial candidate Newt Bueller. Audio from that interview is used in an attack ad put together by a labor union group called Defend Oregon Values. Almost sounds like a conservative group, but they're not. This union bunch used my interview without my permission and without even crediting where they stole it. But hey, it's a labor union, Democrats. You kind of expect a little bit of thievery. What makes it especially crazy is they attack Buehler on abortion. You see, Governor Brown is so-called pro-choice as a candidate, and so is Buehler. Both Brown and Buehler reject the idea of making abortion illegal. I disagree with Buehler on that, but otherwise he's a great candidate for governor. Kate is desperate because she's done a very poor job as governor. The most recent polls done just a few weeks ago show the race is now a dead heat. So a Republican, for a change, has a good chance to beat an Oregon Democrat Party candidate for governor for the first time in a third of a century. I guess that kind of desperation leads to attacking your opponent on something you both agree on. If you're tired of forests on fire, bankrupting public pension debt, and even higher taxes, you have a chance to make a change in less than 90 days. From Facebook and our page, The Lars Larson Show. Lars, on the Fox News page, did you see the story on these electric scooters? Well, Southern California has them, and residents are fed up. People are throwing them into the ocean, piling them 10 feet high in garbage cans. They hate them, and Portland just got them. It's those rent-a-scooter things. I guess people run signals and cut in and out and do the normal skateboard kinds of things. Our Facebook page is The Lars Larson Show.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, granite, topsoil, or sand. Let Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks put it where you want it.
Well, today's Daily Grill, I'm going to give to a federal judge, and he's quoted by WND.com. A U.S. district judge in Oregon has recently ruled that boys must be allowed to use the girls' locker room, showers, and bathrooms, and vice versa in public schools throughout the state. According to Judge Marco Hernandez, for children to, quote, see or be seen by someone of the opposite biological sex while either undressing or performing bodily functions in a restroom, a shower, or a locker room does not give rise to a constitutional violation. Perhaps not, but it does violate normal standards of decency, writes WND. The judge offered an alternative to parents who disagree, telling them to send their kids to a private school. That way, not only do they get their conservative beliefs trampled on, they also get to pay taxes to support public school trampling on their conservative beliefs and private school tuition at the same time. What a deal! It is within parent plaintiff's right to remove their children from the Dallas, Oregon high school if they disapprove of transgender student access to facilities, writes the judge. Once the parents have chosen to send their kids to school, their liberty interest in their children's education is severely diminished. I suggest you take that to heart when you go to the polls to vote on the latest public school bond. You can just tell your friends, no, I voted no on that because my interest in my children's education is severely diminished because they have to go to public schools. And parents and their point of view are not welcome there. Wayne Mayo, who signs himself as a listener since Lincoln was president, writes today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Lars, I was talking to a U of O freshman who lifeguards where I swim in the mornings. She told me that on her application to get into the U of O, they asked her if she needed a, quote, safe space. Wimps. They want to raise lefty wimps. I told her this morning the faculty was going to try and make her into a good liberal as their staff was about 95% Democrat. Is that the number you remember? Hopefully I'm not too far off, signed Wayne Mayo. Wayne is absolutely right. The most recent survey, and this was a few years ago, of professors at the University of Oregon, with about 300 faculty staff, there are about 8 registered Republicans out of 300. That's what happens to diversity in a school run by liberals who hire the people who agree with them. 8 Republicans out of 300 people on the teaching staff. If that's what constitutes diversity, at least diversity of thought, I guess we'll have to consider that the new definition at the U of O. If anybody knows a better or newer number, I'd be glad to hear it. Now, I do want to credit this story. It has to do with the current governor's race. Governor Kate Brown running for re-election and Newt Buehler running to replace her and put a Republican in place for the first time in a third of a century. Well, Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, was in town recently. He was in town for the Clackamas County Fair last week, and he made mention that Governor Kate Brown is not a Christian. He said, let's pray for your governor, Governor Brown. Wouldn't it be something if she got saved? Well, the story by the Tribune, which also quotes political reporter Jeff Mapes, goes on to talk about the fact that apparently she is a pagan. That is, a pagan is somebody who believes in other than the world's major religions. And you know the major religions are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Well, Kate Brown doesn't believe in any of those. In fact, apparently Jeff Mapes went off to talk to her about that. And he says, that was the first time I heard a governor identifying their religious beliefs as being a yogi. Now, I always thought that Yogi was Boo-Boo's friend in the cartoons, but apparently Kate Brown says that she is not a Christian. She's not a follower of Islam. She's not a follower of Judaism. She is, well, not an agnostic by her definition, but she is instead a yogi. She also declined to comment specifically on whether or not she believes in the existence of God. She says, I believe that each one of us has a spirit living within us, and we have to acknowledge the spirit within all human beings. She also lives by a principle of treating human beings with respect. Well, except for the ones that aren't born yet, in which case you can dispose of them for whatever reason you want because the governor believes in abortion. In any case, the governor does not indicate that she believes in God. And when Jeff Mapes talked to Chris Pear, who is the governor's communications director, he said Brown was making a bit of a joke when she claimed that her religious affiliation was being a yogi. But she apparently chooses not to say what it is, and she says she doesn't necessarily believe in God. So my question to you would be, how do you feel about casting a ballot to reelect a pagan governor for the state of Oregon? I would think it would give you pause, and you might want to ask, why would I want to put somebody into such an important position who does not have some kind of external grounding for her beliefs and for her actions? I think that's kind of important, and I think that Franklin Graham made a good point. You have a governor who's not a Christian, not Jewish, not a follower of Islam. Does that make a difference to you? We might even put that up tomorrow as the Twitter poll. In any case, today's Twitter poll we'll get to in a bit. And I'm glad to take your calls at 866-439-5277. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I started hearing about this story on Saturday morning. The story of a man who apparently stole an airplane from the airline that he worked for, Horizon Air, part of the Alaska Airlines chain of, of jets. And this man went out and stole a plane on Friday night, went out and did some mid-air aerobatics over Puget Sound, and then he crashed into an island. They couldn't talk him into landing at a runway. He said that if he landed, he expected to be roughed up and that he might be put in jail. So he refused to do that. His name was Richard Russell. He went by the name Bebo for some reason. And by all accounts, he was a very nice guy. He was a guy that people said, as they often say about people who end up in the news, he was the nicest guy. He was pleasant. They called him a high school football standout, a Christian youth leader. He once operated a bakery with his wife. He was 29 years old, and he died in the crash of that Bombardier Q400 turboprop on Ketron Island, just west of Steilacoom, south of the city of Seattle. Chuck Weiss is a good friend of many years who's a retired airline pilot, and I wanted to ask Chuck about this. Chuck, welcome back to the program. What should we make of the fact that a guy with no pilot's license and apparently no formal training that we know of or can find out about was able to not only get this plane positioned with an on-the-ground tractor, but able to start the plane up, take off, and apparently with no experience at all in flying airplanes, was able to fly the way he did?
Well, Lars, I think the only rational answer to it is there was a lot of luck involved, and he had some, combining with some knowledge that he had that he obviously obtained about that aircraft during the time he was employed as a ground-type service person. He obviously had knowledge of how to probably remove gear pins and install them, being a ground operations-type person. He knew how to operate the aircraft tugs to position an aircraft because that was part of his routine job. What was amazing was that he had knowledge that he obtained somehow of how to operate the aircraft get it started in the condition that it was in, bring the props out of feather with the condition levers. There's a whole bunch of things that have to be done to get that aircraft to start moving when you start it. And in the maintenance position that it was in, I doubt very much whether a GPU is connected, and even if it was, he wouldn't. He had to do this by himself, a ground power unit, that is. So he would have had to start the aircraft up using a battery, and there's a bunch of things you have to do to make that happen as well, or you won't get both engines started successfully. And then he had to be able to taxi out to an active runway and then advance the power levers to take off. I don't even know if he knew anything about flap settings, CG limits, and what that would have been for one person and 2,000 pounds of fuel. There's just a lot of things, I think, combined with minimal knowledge and luck that got him off the ground. And then I listened to the air traffic control tapes, and this guy was under the belief that he could safely operate this aircraft by playing video games. He might have done some video game flying or something, learned the basics of how to operate a control yoke, you know, to turn an aircraft to cause it to climb and descend. But it's amazing that he was able to pull some of this stuff off without killing himself before he actually did.
Well, and that's the thing I wonder about is, does it suggest that perhaps as a ground guy, I've heard him referred to as rampers, a guy who works on the ramp and deals with luggage, things like that, that maybe he befriended a pilot or a co-pilot and said, hey, show me how some of this stuff works. Does this suggest that perhaps he would have had to have done a certain amount, maybe even a month's or more of preparation to be able to take one of these planes and start it up on his own?
Yeah, I think he probably would ask a question. I'm just guessing, of course. I have no idea, but he obviously had to get some knowledge from somewhere, so he might have gotten it piecemeal-wise by asking simple questions to flight crews about some of the controls in the cockpit and how they work. He might have actually obtained information about the Q400 from training manuals. Who knows? There's probably different ways to get it if you really set your mind to do it, and he obviously had to study it enough to where he knew exactly what to do and when to do it to start the aircraft engines up and get the aircraft ready to taxi out to the runway. And it was positioned on the north side of SeaTac Field, so from where it was, there was a minimal distance he knew he would only have to go to get to an active runway. I think it turns out he was taking off into conflicting traffic. I think they were landing to the north and he took off to the south, because I think if he would have tried to taxi the aircraft to the to a north-facing runway on the other end of the field, somebody would have stopped him. He wouldn't have been able to get out to the runway and take off.
I'm talking to retired airline pilot Chuck Weiss, who's a friend of mine and a good friend of the show. So at that point, once he's got the thing moving, there's not much anybody on the ground could have done to stop him, was there?
No, because I think he went straight to an active runway. He ignored the inquiries from air traffic control, so he disobeyed anything on ground frequency. I don't even know if he had that frequency up or what he had on his radio. He was communicating with ATC after he took off, because the conversations we knew that took place. So that's another thing. He knew how to operate the aircraft radios. I don't know if he knew what all the frequencies were, but he had to have known some of that because he was talking with them. He knew how to key the mics. He knew how to punch certain things on the radio to get it to work and to communicate that way. So he had a lot of knowledge for somebody without any pilot certificate at all.
Chuck, tell me this. The simplest automobile on the ground takes a key to operate, but that's not the case with aircraft, or is it? And should it be the case that you need to have a key to start an aircraft?
Well, they secure aircraft after 9/11 with the fortified cockpit doors. And before I had retired at Delta, some of the aircraft that were left overnight for a next day flight, the aircraft cockpit doors were closed and, of course, locked, so that you'd have to put a security code in the next day in order to unlock the door and get into the cockpit. Whether they're going to start doing that routinely now, I don't know. But it wasn't done routinely all the time, but there were certain places where we would park the aircraft at night where we did do that. But outside of having a fortified door, no, there isn't a key, because there's a number of things you have to do to even start an engine, and you'd have to have a lot of knowledge to be able to do that. It's far more complicated than just turning a key to an ignition and getting it started. So, no, normally they're not, because nobody ever thought that you'd have somebody without significant training be able to get into the cockpit, know where everything is located and how exactly how it works, and make it work in such a way to start engines. And of course, with a jet engine and a large turbojet aircraft, it would have been probably impossible to pull that off, because you'd have to get it away from the gate, and that would be impossible to do without a lot of other people helping you. So he had just the right size of transport category aircraft and just the right knowledge to position it, get in by himself, close the door, get into the cockpit, and activate all the switches and controls necessary to fire the engines off and bring the props out of feather and start taxiing for a takeoff.
Chuck, any comment on the kind of aerobatics that he engaged in? He wasn't just flying flat and level.
No, he did some loops from what I saw in the videos, which in a transport category aircraft like that is strictly prohibited. He went way over in order to successfully pull off a loop. The transport category aircraft, you can bring them down to minus 1G and up to maybe 2.5. That's the maximum G loading on it, and 60 degrees of roll and 30 degrees of pitch maximum for those type of aircraft. So when you're going to do a roll, you're going way up over the limits of that. So he had not only put himself and people on the ground in extreme danger by attempting the maneuver, which he did, the aircraft could have suffered control damage in the maneuver that would have made it impossible to fly. You could have stalled one of the wings through an accelerated stall, leading to an uncontrollable, unusual attitude, which you couldn't recover from the altitudes he was doing this at. Or you could have even caused the aircraft to go into a spin, which would have been just as disastrous. In the end, this guy killed himself. But had he done this and lost control over where he was doing the maneuvers, he could have killed people on the ground, because he was operating over a very populated part of the southern part of Puget Sound when he was doing this. So that was another just sheer luck that he was able to do a loop and come out the bottom of that thing without crashing the aircraft. And he came dangerously close to the ground.
How from the videos that you've seen, how close do you think he came? I think he was over water at one point. How close do you think he came to the ground or water?
Oh, I think he was less than 50 feet from the ground, maybe only 20 by the time he came out the bottom part of that roll. And you know, you just don't do that unless you're a very skilled aerobatic pilot. And you know, you see this in the air shows, but they're operating at an airport where if something happens, they're not going to crash into a bunch of people. They have specific areas that they do this at, and of course, their skill level is exceptional. This guy had never done any of this stuff before, and like I said, it's just lucky that he was able to come out the top side of that loop and still have the airplane under control to come down on the bottom side without having stalled the wings.
Well, and Chuck, if for people who've listened to this program before, they've heard you tell the story of sitting there in the cockpit ready to take off in a jet and looking across the water to downtown Manhattan, where 9/11, the terrorist attack, had just occurred, and seeing the smoke going up from the buildings. You've told that story on this show before. It occurs, and I think it immediately occurred to people, he could have taken that plane into downtown Seattle, and he could have hurt or killed a lot of people.
Absolutely, he could have, because there wouldn't have been enough time. When he took off and they realized, when the air traffic controllers in the tower cab at SeaTac realized something was terribly wrong, maybe even possibly terror-related, they got a hold of the nearest military facilities, and the ones that would have protected Seattle's airspace are not at McCord, but they're down in Portland. So they scrambled F-15 fighter jets to go up to try to intercept him in case there was terror involved. But the sad part of the story is, had that been his intention, I don't think those jets could have got up there in time to stop him, because he would have only had to make a sharp right turn. Downtown Seattle is only a matter of, 20 miles or less to SeaTac Field, and he could have made that to any of those buildings and or any structure he wanted and crashed the aircraft before the jets could have intercepted him.
Yeah, I've talked to those pilots before, and they tell me they can make that trip. They did it once when Obama was visiting Seattle, and a plane came in without a transponder, and they scrambled those guys. I think they told me it was 13 and a half or 14 minutes for them to get there once they're called. But even then, as you say, if he had taken that turn towards Seattle and headed toward downtown, 20 miles at what's the likely speed of that plane as he was flying it?
If he'd had the power levers advanced to a takeoff position, which I'm sure he would, and I don't know whether he even managed the power correctly after takeoff, but when the terrorists at 9/11 operated, they were way over the limits, operating limits of the aircraft. It was amazing that those jet engines in the 9/11 terror attacks didn't come apart either. So the chances are, if he had made a turn and was holding level flight at takeoff power, he would have gotten to downtown Seattle very quick. He would have been doing a 250 knots. knots or better.
Yeah, so 20 miles at 250 knots takes almost no time at all, certainly less time than it takes to get those jets north. Chuck, thank you very much. Any other observations on what happened and what do you think the response to it ought to be?
Well, I just think that the number one thing that came to my mind when I heard about how this guy had pulled this off is I think everybody in the aviation community has to realize now that there can be things like this that can happen. There's enough knowledge out there. You know, the Internet, there's all kinds of ways to obtain things. And perhaps people can, with minimal training and skill, get enough in their head and with enough practice do what the 9/11 terrorists did. And so in terms of aircraft being on the ground and at night, away from gates where there's not a lot of people, there probably has to be more enhanced security. That's one thing I don't think anybody really thought of too well, because we just figured you're not going to ever have to worry about that. There's too many complicating things that would keep somebody from starting up an aircraft and getting airborne with it, which is what this guy did. So I think it's going to be a security-related thing more than anything else.
You bet. Chuck Weiss, retired airline pilot, global warming debunker, and a good friend of the program. Chuck, thanks so much for your insights.
You're quite welcome, Lars.
Take care now. Back in just a moment, we'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've got to mention this one issue that's come up. It kind of came up while I was gone on vacation, but now I'm back. There is a famous theater in Seattle, the Showbox, and they've had a lot of bands that have played there. They have a lot of fans in the city and probably throughout the region as well. The problem is, apparently it's not financially sustainable, which shouldn't surprise anyone. The entertainment business is a tough one. And now a British Columbia developer has announced plans to tear down the theater and put up a $100 million, 44-story condo tower, which I look at and say, great, you're putting the property to its highest and best use. Everybody who loves the Showbox Theater, I take nothing away from you. But if it is not financially sustainable, you should expect it to be sold and redeveloped into something that is financially sustainable. Here's where it gets bizarre. Shama Sawant, the full-blown socialist who's on the city council in Seattle, has apparently announced that the city is going to use the mechanisms that it has to make it hard to develop those condos. So in a city that is crying for more housing, and this would be 450 units of housing, in a city that is begging for more housing to be built, Shama Sawant, the socialist, is going to do everybody the favor of saying, we're going to make it harder to build the housing. That kind of insanity has to stop. She needs to be gone from the Seattle City Council at the next election. Naysayer Morgan is on the line. You heard my comments about pagan Kate Brown, who apparently doesn't believe in God and is a yogi. What do you think of that? Would you vote for her?
Yeah, I would, Lars. Are you a Christian yourself?
Yes.
Because I know some other talk shows in Salem and Eugene in Bend that they are a little bit more evangelical about their Christianity. You don't really talk about God much on the air.
I think you ask my producers, you hear mention about once a week. But do I go out and start every sentence with God tells me to do this and God tells me to do that? No. My Christianity is my beliefs. But what does that have to do with your naysaying?
I'm a naysayer in that there's no evidence for God, and
is evidence for God, intelligent design. If you look around you and you say all of this just happened because of mistake, because the right chemicals combined with the other right chemicals, if you believe that, show me the evidence. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. I'm back from vacation, and I know my vacation sometimes frustrates some of you. Well, be assured I'm back here, and when we hit the fall, I don't take any vacations at all, at least until we come to Christmas time. Glad to have you with me. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Down in the mid-Willamette Valley, there is a question about what is being done to a major lake that is also a major water supply for some major communities. And the question is whether or not Detroit Lake should be drained to make way for a $250 million project that is essentially an effort to try to make sure the fish
get around a major dam and also to address water temperatures and the like. And Colm Willis is running for Marion County Commissioner. Colm, good to have you back on the program. Why did this one grab your attention?
Well, because it would have such a big impact in Marion County, Lars. Thanks for having me on the show. This jumped back up to the top of everybody's mind because the Army Corps of Engineers just issued its alternatives report and held a meeting in Staten where it discussed our input, the input of the citizens of Marion County on their proposed project.
And the project is what, a 300-foot tower that would sit inside the reservoir and allow the fish to be able to get around the dam and safely down. And it would also address water temperatures to some extent. Is this worth $250 million of the taxpayers' money?
Well, that's a serious question. It's not just the dollar amount, though, Lars. It's the impact it's going to have on all of Marion County. According to their plan, they want to drain the entire lake to build this basically a skyscraper inside of the lake in order to mix the water together so that it's the right temperature, I guess. The problem is Salem's water supply is totally dependent on Detroit Lake, as is Staten's water supply where I live. There's no alternative, and we need a certain flow rate in order for our treatment plants to work. So if they drain that lake, we won't have the water that we need for people to drink. It'll actually create a drought in Marion County. And a lot of our farmers depend on that water as well to irrigate their crops. Turns out that agriculture is the number one private industry in Marion County, and Marion County is the top agriculture producer in the state of Oregon. So this could potentially create an economic disaster in Marion County as well. And then Detroit, which is where the lake is located, there's a number of small businesses that rely on the lake to stay in business. And if they drain this lake for 2 years, those businesses won't be able to make it. So it's not just the cost to the federal government and ultimately the taxpayers. It's the human cost that this would have. It would just be devastating.
If they don't do it, what has the Corps of Engineers said will be the result? In other words, I guess if we're looking at this as alternatives, then you have to say, well, if we don't do this plan, then what bad things will happen? Apparently, the fish and the dam and everything else have been getting along just fine for what, decades without this improvement? So how much would this thing be worth? Not in dollar terms, but in terms of fixing a problem. And is there really enough of a problem to justify a 2-year shutdown, draining of the lake, interrupting a major city, two major cities' water supplies, and perhaps destroying some businesses?
Well, we don't know. They've built towers like this in other places, and the fish haven't come back. So to a certain extent, this is a bit speculative on the part of the Army Corps of Engineers. But there are these extreme environmental groups that are suing the Corps, saying they need to build this thing, and they need to build it now. And thankfully, the city of Salem intervened in that lawsuit and said, hey, you know, both of you guys agreed to drain the lake. We need somebody who thinks that this is a bad idea. And Lars, what's so frustrating, the thing that I think makes Marion County folks so angry about this situation, is that almost a year ago, the Army Corps said, hey, we want to hear your ideas. We want to hear how this would impact you.
Yeah.
And a number of us gave comments, gave alternative ideas, gave different suggestions as to how they could, you know, solve the problem they're trying to solve without draining the lake. And I went to this meeting thinking that the Army Corps was going to seriously tell us, you know, what some of the other options are other than draining the lake. But the whole meeting was just why their plan is the best and why everybody else's input wasn't right. And
so,
I just found that to be incredibly condescending.
You know, it's funny, just a few weeks ago, Colm, we were talking about the fact that state governments throughout the Northwest will routinely hold public hearings in which they've already effectively announced, we're going to go ahead and do what it is we're proposing to do, but we have to go through the motions of pretending to listen to your point of view so we can make a record and say we did listen to the public, even though in real terms they may have heard what you said, but they didn't actually listen to you, there being a difference between hearing somebody and actually listening to them.
That was absolutely my impression, is that they already had their mind made up. And the only thing that was a bit of a silver lining was our current county commissioner, Sam Brentano, stood up and said that, you know, the Marion County commissioner is going to fight with everything they have and is going to sue them and put as many roadblocks in the way as possible to protect the people of Marion County. And I couldn't agree more. If I'm elected to serve on the county commission this fall, I'm going to sign up with San Brentano, and we're going to fight this thing as far as we need to.
Now, what's the likelihood that a suit like that will win, especially considering that the Army Corps of Engineers is already under either threat of lawsuit or being sued from the other side, who says you have to do this?
Well, we have to get in the fight. We have to protect the people of Marion County. The Army Corps did say that they're considering what they call building in the wet, which means that instead of draining the lake, they'll build this tower essentially underwater, is my understanding. But they don't want to do that.
Why not? What's the downside to doing it that way? Did they say?
Well, they're concerned about the safety of the folks working on this structure.
And I
understand that. Yeah. And I'm sympathetic to that, actually. But it is possible. My perspective is, look, the Army Corps of Engineers are the experts. This is what they do. This is what our tax dollars pays them to do, is to figure out how to build complicated structures. And if they're going to build a complicated structure, or they're going to address an environmental issue in Detroit Lake, they have to do it in a way that doesn't cause a drought and doesn't cause an economic disaster in Marion County.
I mean, because you make a really sensible argument that if you have the major water supply for hundreds of thousands of people, you have to be concerned about the safety of divers or people who would work underwater to try to build this thing without draining the lake. But you also have to be concerned about the safety of two huge communities and the water supply that they depend on. And as you said, what a lot of people don't remember or think about is you not only have to have the water to drink and to operate homes and businesses and all that, but if there isn't enough water in the sewage treatment plant, those things don't work either. So you got to have both sides of that equation.
That's right. And frankly, I just expected a higher level of thought and consideration of some of the other ideas that had been suggested. And these weren't just ideas from Joe Citizen. I mean, there were very sophisticated engineering firms that submitted different ideas, but it didn't seem like the Army Corps of Engineers cared at all.
Well, if people want to join your effort to fight this thing, is there a way to do that?
Yeah, I'm going to submit a letter to our federal delegation demanding that they put pressure on the Army Corps of Engineers to address the concerns of the community here in Marion County. And so I direct them to my website, ColumWillis.com, and ask them to sign that letter.
Very good. Colum, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lars. Appreciate it.
You bet. That's Colum Willis, who's running for Marion County Commissioner. Let me go to Jesse, who's in Vancouver. Jesse, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. How are you?
I'm doing good, Lars. How you doing?
Not too bad. You called in because I raised the question whether or not you want to reelect a pagan governor and whether or not it makes a difference that Kate Brown says she's not even sure she believes in the existence of God.
Well, I'll tell you what, regardless, pagan, snagan, I'll tell you what, I've been on the show about two or three times now, and I tell you, one of the best aspects of the show here is you guys always have the most controversial topics. I tell you, Kate Brown, she's a wonderful woman, but her religious intent should not weigh in on her professional demeanor. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't know what you mean, because when you say she's a wonderful woman, can you tell me one wonderful thing about Governor Kate Brown? Just one.
Well, in order to get to a politician-type status, you got to be somewhat of a wonderful person in one aspect or another in order to get there.
No, you don't. There are plenty of creeps who are politicians.
Seemingly so.
Jesse, you're starting with a premise that to be a politician or to get elected to office, you have to be a wonderful person. Neil Goldschmidt raped a child for 3 years. He became governor. Sam Adams chased a teenage boy around for a couple of years. He became mayor. You had a mayor in Seattle who committed sexual offenses or was accused of, so he was credibly accused of committing sexual offenses against teenage boys. So if you start from the premise that to be an elected official, you have to be a wonderful person, I can give you dozens of examples around the country and around the Northwest of real creeps and criminals who become politicians. Do you want to rethink your proposition that all politicians have to be wonderful to get elected?
Now, I don't think that you took what I was trying to tell you in the right way there, Lars. What I'm trying to say to you is that
Kate Brown, she seems to be a wonderful person.
I just asked you, Jesse, I asked you, tell me one wonderful person.
Let's get down to the nitty gritty. What I'm trying to tell you, Lars, is that her religious affiliations should not be weighing in on her ability to do her job.
Well,
right?
So let me ask you a question about that.
She likes to go out on the moon and dance in the forest.
Hey, Jesse, do you believe in God?
Thing is that, you know,
Jesse,
we got to rely on people
Jesse,
to make the right choices for us.
Jesse, do you believe in God?
Yes, Lars, I'm listening
is,
to you.
Is that an... I said, do you believe in God?
Yeah.
I think we faded out on him. Are you still there, Jesse?
I'm still here, Lars.
Do you believe in God? It's a simple question, yes or no?
Yes, I do, Lars.
Is that an important belief to in your heart? Because there are unimportant
heart,
beliefs
yes.
Like I believe vanilla ice cream is better than chocolate, but it's not that important. I could give it up tomorrow. My belief in God is significant to who I am and how I behave. If you meet somebody who's a politician running for office and they say, not even sure God exists, you're telling me that's not important?
Well, it shouldn't weigh on a person's ability to do their job.
Why not?
Why not? I'm trying to tell you.
Can you tell me without...
Religious affiliation doesn't have anything to do with...
I didn't say affiliation. I said belief in God.
It's a personal belief.
No, it's not. It has an effect on how you behave. If you have somebody who does not believe in a supreme being, doesn't believe in God, where do you draw your moral direction from without that?
Well, in order to draw moral direction, you don't need to believe in a higher power.
Yes, I believe you do. Tell me something, Jesse.
It's been proven time and time again that it's not true.
How do you decide what's right or wrong if you don't have some... In other words, if God doesn't say it's wrong to kill, it's wrong to commit adultery, it's wrong to do those things, where would you get those beliefs in what are the right and wrong things to do in life?
Well, we're always changing with the times. Back
well,
a long
some
time
of us
ago,
are
those
not.
Things weren't as much.
Some of us stick to our values, and our values come from a particular place. Kate Brown apparently doesn't share those values, but she'd like to be your governor. And it might explain where she comes from on the question of abortion. Back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, while I was on my break with Tina doing that cross-country drive, I heard this story about how Special Olympics, which has, to this point, consistently refused to come on this program and talk about their financial difficulties, I heard a story that Special Olympics had made off with some money that was specially set aside for the Special Olympics program in Cottage Grove by a woman who passed away, and she left a considerable sum, about $50,000 to Special Olympics. And Carmen Dowell has been dogging this issue because she wants to know what in the world happened to all that. Ms. Dowell, thank you very much for taking the time today to call in.
You are very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, do you mind outlining this for my listeners as to what happened and why you feel, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but money came from the community of Cottage Grove, fundraising money, dues money, and money, of course, from this woman's wonderful, what do you call it? Not bequeathment, but the money that she left behind after she passed was left for Special Olympics. And now the money seems to have mostly disappeared. What happened?
Well, so that's correct. So basically, Michelle Portman left us in her trust $50,000 designated for our local Cottage Grove Special Olympics program. So that was put in our regular account, which is Special Olympics has like one giant account, but we all have our little sub, you know, reports that we get from that account. And before we even received that $50,000, it's important to know that we had a balance of $13,000 before that.
Right.
So we were doing pretty good with money. And then recently, I think it was two Tuesdays ago, we had a webinar with the people in Special Olympics Oregon, and they basically told us that no money was left, and they were canceling the fall bowling and the winter basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So I had asked, well, we have our money. We have 50-something thousand dollars in our account, so would it be okay if we still do our bowling just on a local level and not have a regionals? And Mark Hankin told me, I don't know what you're talking about. You don't have no $50,000. And so I was just like, wait a minute. Yes, we do. And, you know, they said, well, we'll talk to you tomorrow. So the next day they call me and we have a phone conference and they tell me that they can't find the $50,000. There never was $50,000. And if I could prove it to them, they would try to do what they could to return it, but it would take many years.
Has any of that been resolved at this point?
Yes, because now they've changed their story again. So I was able to find the $50,000 within a half hour and send it to them. A copy of the check, a copy of the trust, everything. I am friends with Michelle Portman's sister, who was the person in charge of her living trust. So send it all to them, and they say, oh, well, you spent it. I'm like, no, we didn't spend it. So long story short, about 5 years ago, Special Olympics decided that they would get everyone who goes to Summer State Games, which was canceled this year,
yeah.
So nobody went. Everybody who goes to Summer State Games, they pay up front.
Carmen, I'm up against a break, but we want to follow up with you. As new developments happen, please call me, and we will make sure to get the information out. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Here in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of people are mindful of the fact that the idea of the original deposit bottle or can came from here in the Pacific Northwest. I actually met the man who's since passed away, named John Passantini, who actually came up with the idea, or at least he came up with the best way to demonstrate it by offering, I think at the time it was a half a penny or a penny per bottle or can. He ended up being buried almost in bottles and cans. It showed that people would bring them back for a certain deposit. And then for a long time, we had a nickel deposit on bottles and cans, at least in the state of Oregon. Many other states followed suit. But part of that law also said if the number of cans and bottles returned falls below a certain percentage of the bottles and cans that are sold, then the deposit has to double. And that has happened. The new deposit law went into effect on the 1st of January. So now it's 10 cents. So it's considerably more, especially if you buy a lot of soda pop or beer, that kind of thing. What wasn't intended was that certain kinds of containers were not covered by the deposit. And I was contacted by Paul Ruggles, who's bringing this issue up because they're finding that at least one major retailer in the Northwest, Fred Meyer, has apparently been charging a deposit on containers that you wouldn't ordinarily think would be covered by the deposit, but apparently they're not redeeming those containers. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lars. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just fine. So tell me what you found out about certain Fred Meyer stores in the Northwest.
Well, the following stores are charging the 10 cents, and there could be more. Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, Forest Grove, Kaiser, all the Salem stores, Springfield, Tiger, Tualatin, and Wilsonville.
And you also know that there's a list of cities, Bend, Canby, Gresham, Newport, and Roseburg, where they're not charging it. Have you been able to get an explanation from the company as to why this company that doesn't have franchise stores, as far as I know, all the stores are owned by the Kroger Corporation, they're charging the deposit on these wax containers of orange juice in some places, but not charging it everywhere. Why? What have they told you?
We do not know why they're charging in some stores and not in others.
Fred Meyer has not told you.
Fred Meyer has not told us, no.
Have you found out any information, say, not officially from the company as to why this might be happening?
Well, we know that on July 24th, somebody contacted Fred Meyer after 2 hours of research and pointed out that they're unlawfully enriching themselves, but they did not do anything about it that we know of.
And when you say unlawfully enriching themselves, charging a 10-cent deposit on Florida's natural orange juice in a 59-ounce wax container or a container with cardboard coated with wax, but when you try to redeem the container for the deposit, the store says, no, we don't redeem those, correct?
Correct.
Was there an explanation when you show a receipt to the store clerk and say, look, I bought this. It was full of orange juice. The orange juice is gone. You charged a 10-cent deposit. We'd like to get the deposit back. Why they weren't willing to redeem it?
They offered a 20-cent return to one of our friends, but they did not give an explanation.
Okay. But as far as you know, they're still charging the deposit on these containers. Is that legal for them to charge a deposit on that kind of container?
As of an hour ago, they were still charging on the Florida Naturals, but not the Minute Maid in the wax container. And it is no, it is not legal for them to charge this.
So what are you going to do?
We are filing a class action lawsuit, and we're asking your listeners, if they have been harmed, to check their receipts and sign up at the website.
So there'd be a class action lawsuit to challenge Fred Meyer's practice of charging this deposit, but not only charging it on a container for which it's not approved, but also refusing to redeem the container later.
Right.
So what do you want the company to do?
We'd like them to take note of this. This is an unlawful practice, and they're, you know, it's an inconsistent policy across these lines, so it's an unfair advantage, and the collecting is unlawful.
What is legal, and what does the law say about what kinds of containers can have the charge applied to it, and which kinds of containers are exempt?
These products, can you say that again, Lars?
Yeah, what does the law actually say about which containers can be charged a deposit and which containers cannot? Because clearly, a lot of kinds of containers are not covered by the law, but some containers are. Soda pop is, beer is. I think the iced tea in bottles is covered by the deposit law. What does the law say about what containers you can charge a deposit on?
I'm not a lawyer or an expert, but this one is exempt. And if you have any questions, we have a lawyer that would be happy to come into the studio and do an interview.
Okay, very good. Anything else people should know about this?
If you could give them the link to the website that I sent you, that would be great.
We'd be glad to do it. Do you want to say it? Is it an easy one, or is it a long, complicated website?
It's Fred Meyer. Let me get it for you really quick here.
Okay, no problem. We're talking to Paul Ruggles, who's a plaintiff in the class action lawsuit against Fred Meyer, charging that the company is charging a deposit for some containers and not for others. What is it, Paul?
It's FredMeyerCustomers.com.
FredMeyerCustomers.com. That seems pretty simple. Paul, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Lars.
You bet. Take care now. Let me go to your calls now. Glad to be back from vacation, by the way. I always like going on vacation, but I always love coming home as well. Naysayer Steve in Beaverton, you heard me talking about the fact that we've now learned from both the Portland Tribune and from political reporter, OPB political reporter, Jeff Mapes, that apparently the governor of Oregon does not have a particular religion. She says she's a yogi, and when asked whether or not she believes in God, she says she's not sure. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that at all, Lars. And, you know, this idea that you have to subscribe to some type of theistic belief to have any type of morality, that seems pretty intellectually dubious to me, Lars. I don't think so.
Here's what I get it from, and then you tell me where I'm wrong. I have a sense of right and wrong, but an awful lot of that comes from my belief that, you know, that Jesus Christ is my Savior, and that I believe in God. Now, that's where we draw many of our rules from. Where would you draw your moral direction from as to what's right or wrong if you do not draw it from the idea that you're not just an animal, a very complicated animal as a human being, but you're not just an animal, and that you actually have some sense of what's right and what's wrong? Where does yours come from?
Mylar, it comes from the philosophy of John Locke, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
He's
a favorite philosopher of conservatives.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you're familiar with his concept of natural rights, which says that, you know, the basic law of nature is for mankind to preserve mankind. He said we have a duty and an obligation to preserve mankind. And we do that through a set of laws, which certainly can be incorporated through a religious or a theist context.
Well, I'll tell you what. Can I test it? Can I test that on you?
If I can test it on you afterwards.
Please, please do. So, I believe thou shalt not steal. Now, that one comes, you know, from my religious beliefs. I could say it's my own, but it's because I've incorporated my religious beliefs into my heart in a way that I don't even know if I could describe it. But if I was hungry and you had food and I had no food, the idea of preserving human beings would tell me I have a right to go and take that food because I need it to exist. But the Ten Commandments tells me I shouldn't steal. Thou shalt not steal. It's not even that I shouldn't steal. Thou shalt not steal is a directive. Don't steal, period. So if you say that the, you know, that under Locke's philosophy, that your job is to preserve, that your belief is that humanity should be preserved, is it okay to steal food?
It could be or it couldn't be, but here's the other.
Hold on a second.
No.
When you're going to tell me you have a moral direction, and I say, is it right or left, and you say it could be right and it could be left, you don't have much of a moral compass. Then it sounds like.
No. Here's the other question about.
Hold on, Steve. We had a deal. We had a contract, and the contract was I was going to ask you a question, and then you said if you could ask a question after. You then didn't answer my question, which means we're not on to the next part of the contract yet. I agreed to let you ask a question if you'll answer mine. Is it wrong always to steal?
Yes, Lars, it's wrong always.
And where
to steal
did you get? Where did you get that belief?
From the natural law that you don't have a right to other people's property.
Well, you just told me your base belief is that humanity should be preserved. So if you need food and you don't have any and I have food, what makes it wrong for you to take some of my food to preserve your life or the life of your family? What makes it wrong?
Because it's not my property. It's my property. Are you telling me, Lars, that law is somehow subservient to the law that you're entitled to eat? I mean, I don't get what
nobody
you're
entitles you to eat. Where's the entitlement
okay,
to eat?
Do you remember
what philosophy says you're entitled to eat? Tell the people in the Sudan about that, and they'll bring a lawsuit right now. We're entitled to eat. There's no food here. Help me out. So tell me what makes it wrong to steal if your job, your first job, is to preserve humanity.
Well, I just told you, Lars, you can't preserve humanity if you take other people's property, right?
Sure you can.
If we have people going around taking
If one man has more food than he needs and the other man is starving, is it okay for the man who's starving to steal, take, without permission, some of the food from the man who has more than he needs?
For a third time, Lars, if it is not his property, no, it is not. Where did you get that belief? From John Locke's natural law.
But here's the problem with natural laws made up by men. A law made up by a man can be changed by that same man, can't it?
No, of course it can.
Okay, but a law made up by God, for me, can't be changed. I can't go in and say, hey, God, do you mind if we have an amendment to that thou shalt not steal stuff? Because I don't get to amend that law, but laws created by men can be amended.
Well, wait a minute, Lars. When we created the Constitution, didn't we change some of God's law?
No. What law did we change of God's in the Constitution?
Oh, wait a minute. Are you saying that God said it was okay for us to have slaves?
Where were slaves in the Constitution?
Well, slaves,
slaves were a practice that the Constitution actually rejected. It said all men are equal under the law.
They were labeled three-fifths. They were labeled three-fifths of a person under the law.
And that was that.
They did not have.
And we can get into a long discussion about that. But tell me, where would it be immoral for you to enslave another man? You'd still be preserving humanity. Hold on. You told me that under Locke's philosophy is to preserve humanity. If you say this poor man is starving, I'm going to make him my slave, but he's going to eat well, and he'll have a roof over his head. Would that be moral?
No, Lars, and John Locke.
Why not?
He says that in the duty to preserve society, you have to do things and follow rules that are good for the betterment of society.
Well,
and we have decided.
You had a lot of people in the South who argued that slavery was good for society, and that it was even good for the people who were enslaved. There were people who made that argument because you didn't have any outside moral compass. All you had was laws made up by men, right?
No, Lars. We decided as a society that it was better if we didn't enslave people. It was better for mankind, and I think most people subscribe to that belief today.
Does it tell you anything useful about Kate Brown when Kate Brown says she's not sure she believes in God?
It tells me nothing, Lars. And, you know, the question
nothing at all?
Hold on, nothing at all? Nothing at all, Lars. What should it tell me?
It tells you that this person has a belief that apparently human beings are here because of an accident, a chemical accident that happened millions of years ago, created human beings, and all we are is very complicated animals created by accident, not created by something else. Do you believe that's true?
Okay, and yeah, I believe that's true. I don't think chemical reactions, I wouldn't call them accidents. I think they just are. I don't know if they're accidents.
Well, sure they were accidents. If we hadn't had the right if we hadn't had the right combination of accidental chemical combinations millions, hundreds of millions of years ago, life would not exist, would it?
Right. It's called evolution, Mark.
Well, no, we're just called a happy accident. By the way, there are big gaps in the evolution, evolutionary chain as well, but we can get into that another day. Steve, good naysayer. Thanks for the call. In fact, Steve gets a challenge coin as a result of being a great naysayer, guys. Steve gets a challenge coin. Back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show.
An illegal alien.
They use your health care, drive on your roads, use your schools, and take your jobs.
My fellow Americans and our millions of illegal aliens.
It's time for Lars's illegal play of the day.
Oh, I love this from the Seattle Times Fish Wrapper. Yes, the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper. They tell another one of these boo-hoo stories about illegal aliens, about Erica Lopez and her husband Juan. Erica is an American. Juan is not an American. They say that Juan sneaked into the United States when he was 16. He is now 50. If you do the math on that, he came into the United States at about the time, almost exactly, that the United States was granting amnesty to illegal aliens. They even say that for a time, he became a legal resident of the United States, which means he could have become a citizen, except for one thing. Juan Lopez apparently committed a number of drug crimes. And in fact, he was addicted to drugs for a time, and so he lost his legal residency, and now they're being deported. And it apparently justifies a front page story on the Seattle Times Fish Wrapper about how sad it is that when you want to become a citizen and you violate the laws and you don't fulfill the requirements to become a citizen, that you get kicked out of the country. Too bad. Goodbye. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. I took a two-week vacation to answer the question a few of you have been asking me, and now I am back tanned, rested, and ready, and still wearing most of the beard that I grew during vacation, and I'll be getting rid of that tomorrow. I don't think my granddaughter Payson is going to like that very much, but, you know, she doesn't like when granddad's face is all scratchy and everything. I'm glad to be back with you and glad to be on the Radio Northwest Network. I saw this story while I was on vacation, and the story was a rather sad story. It was about an orca named Taliqua, who had given birth, stillbirth, to a dead calf. And the mother, this orca mother, is holding on to this dead calf. And it seemed to people who anthropomorphize, which is a fancy word for applying human emotions to animals or inanimate objects, whatever. It's the kind of thing you do rather innocently when you say, gee, my dog is smiling. He must be happy today. You know, or you can do it with inanimate objects. You can say, my car hates me this morning. It refuses to start. And people do this anthropomorphizing all the time. And when I heard the story, I thought it's really sad that this baby orca calf has died. But I think it's a little on the goofy side when human beings start trying to attribute emotions to animals who may or may not have any of those reactions. We all imagine, because we're a little bit egocentric, that animals have the same reactions to things that we do. Now, nobody can know for sure. And this came to mind when I read this letter that Todd Myers wrote that was published in a national newspaper, and he called it the immoral reaction to an orca mother's grief. He says emotional events can evoke some poor policy choices. The heartbreaking images of an orca mother named Taliqua clinging to her dead calf are inspiring some dangerous and, frankly, immoral responses. The co-chair of the governor's orca task force, Stephanie Solian, told the Seattle Times recently, I honestly believe that Taliqua is on a mission. the chair of the Spokane City Council, he writes, echoed that sentiment on his Facebook page, saying, this has to be her communicating. And a Pierce County councilman tweeted, this isn't grieving, it's a protest. The orcas are sick of our nonsense, and they want action to save our sound. In other words, this orca whale is commenting on public policy. This is a serious tweet, I guess, unless the Pierce County councilman is pulling our leg. This is saying animals are reacting, like saying the grizzly bears that are being brought into the North Cascades don't like the Seattle City Council's housing policy. This is how goofy it is. So Todd Myers, who's with the Washington Policy Center, who you hear on this program from time to time, he goes on to write, the death of an orca calf should be a call to everyone who cares about Puget Sound and the South resident orca to be more serious about the approach we take. The comments of these politicians show the opposite is happening. They are becoming less rational, more emotional, and less scientific. If these officials and other activists actually believe that they can communicate with the orca can communicate with us, or that the orca understands human politics and policy, then we should resign ourselves to continued failure in efforts to restore salmon in Puget Sound. If, on the other hand, writes Todd, these officials are intentionally making these odd and irrational comments to increase emotion and hysteria in order to affect public policy, the comments are clearly immoral. The goal is to override the science we have on the cause of the orca decline in favor of symbolic, costly, and ineffective approaches. Some are hoping this emotion will help destroy the Snake River dams, writes Todd. This approach is most evident by a comment made by an 11-year-old at the governor's first orca task meeting in Wenatchee, which received a standing ovation from those in the audience. She said, I've been to the Snake River dams and personally witnessed these giant megaliths of death. I've seen fish pressed against the ladders, swimming in circles and getting stuck. That's not natural. That's not okay. By way of contrast, scientists at NOAA Fisheries, among others, argue that destroying the dams is not certain to increase fish populations. They note it would also take many years for the sediment behind the dams to settle, delaying any speculative benefit. For that uncertainty and the hope of a long-term benefit, we would pay billions of dollars in costs and lost electricity and economic activity. If we want to spend billions on salmon recovery, there are many worthwhile projects in Puget Sound and around the state, projects with a high likelihood of success. If those looking to tear down the dams have research that is superior to NOAA Fisheries, they should share it. If they have science showing salmon will recover quickly, again contradicting the science of NOAA, they should offer it. If instead they are appealing to the words of an 11-year-old and communications from an orca, we need to make it clear their proposals are anti-science and will compound the tragedy of the death of the orca calf. Todd Myers is a very smart guy, and I think he saw something important in that. If your local city council member thinks he can talk to the whales, you might want to think about replacing that city council member at the next election. Let's go to Naysayer Mike. Hey, Naysayer Mike, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hey there, Lars. Listen to you all the time. Agree with you on most topics, many topics. But
thank you.
However, with the one, you're talking about Kate Brown's lack of religion.
Yes.
You're a smart guy. I'm guessing you've heard of Bertrand Russell's Teapot.
Remind me, because that one doesn't come immediately to mind.
Okay, so it's this theory that Bertrand Russell came up with this theory that if someone claims that there's the teapot floating in between Mars and the Earth, that there's no way to prove it, and it's up to the person who claims that to prove it, and until it's proven, then it is not a
okay, problem. So in other words, you're using the teapot as a metaphor for God. I get it. But here's my answer, and that is, okay, let's go back to the original question. Is it or is it not significant when a person who either holds public office or seeks to hold public office believes in God? Is it significant to you?
Honestly, I do not think it is significant.
Okay,
especially
fine.
In a country that claims to not be a theocracy.
Oh, no, but hold on. You don't have to be a theocracy for government to be required to be government is required in this country by the Constitution to be blind to religion. That is, I can be a Protestant Christian and run for office. If you're an atheist and you want to run for office, there can be, according to the U.S. Constitution, no religious test for office. That is, you can't say all Muslims are disqualified, all Jews are disqualified. Well, on the other hand, I also can't say you're disqualified by being an atheist, and I'm not suggesting that Kate Brown is disqualified, but I'm asking you whether or not it tells you something important about that person if they have no belief whatsoever in God. I think it does. You've said it doesn't. Well, I'm suggesting that... Go ahead.
No, you go for it.
Well, I'm just suggesting that in the same way that I evaluate candidates by a whole manner of things, I say, do they have any experience?
Sure.
If they have experience, if it's good experience that seems to relate to the office, then that's significant. If they have no experience, I would say that's significant as well. If they have some kind of moral compass that says there are forces, a force, in this case God, outside of us that helps to guide our decisions about right and wrong, that's significant.
Sure.
The previous caller suggested that we should believe in the God of John Locke. Now, he didn't call him a God, but he was effectively saying, let's use Locke's set of rules about how we should behave. There's a problem with using men as gods. And by men, I mean both men and women. If a man says the rule is this, so the King of England says this is the rule, well, then the King of England can change that rule 10 minutes from now. But if you have rights that are given to me by God, I have rights in this country, according to the founders of this country, that came to me because I was created by God, a supreme being. If I have rights that come from men, then those rights can be taken away by men. So... Then what do you do with somebody who believes that God doesn't exist at all? So where do your rights come from?
I think rights come from the collective values of a society.
Well, by that reasoning, the collective values of the South in the United States in the 1850s were that you could have slaves. So then slavery was moral, right?
Sure, but many, many Christians like you, I'm not saying...
No, but answer that one first. If we all collectively decide that when somebody gets to about 75 years of age, they really don't have much life left living, so they should be put down, like you'd put down a pet who's ailing.
Sure, okay, well, here's what I believe. I believe that... As people go through life, they experience things, and that changes their perception on their values.
And sometimes negatively, and sometimes sometimes negatively, and sometimes positively. Correct.
That is true.
Somebody who grows up as a liberal snowflake in America believes that nothing is fair, and you won't get anything unless you take it. And at that point, you become a member of Antifa who says, I want to go out in the streets and smash things because life. No, I'm suggesting these are people whose upbringing apparently led them to believe that the only way to get your point across was go and destroy other things and scare the daylights out of everybody else you live next to. Right.
I agree. But it goes the same way. I mean, there's some people on the other side who think the same, but it.
No. Okay, give me an example.
I just gave you a
real example of people who believe that smashing things and burning things is okay, and that is justified. And you'll hear them justify it. You'll say, "Why? The only way to get our point across is to do this." You give me an example on the other side, as you said. What is it?
On the other side. Okay. So how about? The 86, the anti-drug abuse, law, which caused nonviolent drug crimes to put people away in prison.
You're talking about the law that was actually signed by Bill Clinton in the 90s that made much harsher.
I'm 86. There was the 94, and I'm talking about the 86.
Okay, that you had tough penalties for behaving in an antisocial way that put other people's lives at risk. Yeah.
That, I mean, it could be looked at that way, but...
Well,
but
isn't it that way? Right now, we have 60,000 people a year, 1,000 people a week dying of drug overdoses, and that doesn't count all the people whose lives and whose communities are adversely affected by the drug trade. If you don't believe me, ask the people in Chicago, where every weekend they can anticipate dozens of people being shot, most of them shot over disputes driven by, as you call them, harmless drugs.
Listen, Lars, my dad overdosed and died, okay?
So I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm thank you, but I'm not asking for sympathy. I'm just saying I do understand where you're coming from, but I think it'd be on that topic. I think it just
it just surprises me to have a guy who's describing nonviolent drugs as being nonviolent whose father was taken by drugs. Did you consider your father's passing nonviolent?
I would consider it a product of the environment he lived in.
Well, perhaps. Back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the program. Talking a bit about Oregon's pagan governor, that is Kate Brown, who when asked what her religion is, she said, "I'm a yogi." And then she went on to explain when asked, "Do you believe in God?" She's not sure that she does. She's not sure she doesn't. So I guess that just kind of puts her in the middle. So... either way, doesn't matter, right or left. Let's go to Jim in Oregon City. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Well, I just have a question, actually.
Sure.
Kate Brown is she's got to go, and I will vote for Newt Diller. But I have a problem with him. Does he not also believe or support the abortion issue?
When I did the opening commentary today, I pointed that out. He and Kate Brown are both on the same page. Well, similar pages. Let's put it that way. He would like to see fewer abortions, but he understands the Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision. And he knows that the laws of the state of Oregon, if they're going to reflect having fewer abortions, that they're going to have to be changed. And that requires a vote of the legislature. And right now, he doesn't have the votes. If he became governor in January, he still couldn't change any of those laws. He says that as a doctor, he believes that it should be a decision made by a woman and her physician, a position I don't agree with, but that is his position. I actually kind of started this with the idea that there's an anti-Newt Bueller group is running some ads right now that draw on an interview of Newt Bueller on this program. They didn't get permission to use it, and they don't use it with any kind of attribution as to where it came from. And I objected to that. But he does have the same position. If you want to call him pro-choice, he's pro-choice. Kate Brown is pro-choice. Yep. I don't like the language that pro-choice suggests. But then Ronald Reagan was pro-choice as well. So by that standard. So I pointed out to people that if you don't like Bueller's stance on abortion, you wouldn't have liked Ronald Reagan's stance either. So the answer is yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's my only struggle with him. You know, because pro-choice is pro-choice.
Can I give you, can I give you a difference? And would you have considered Ronald Reagan to be in the same boat on abortion as Kate Brown?
You know, I didn't know that about him.
Well, he believed that you should be able to have access to abortion to save the life of the mother and in cases of rape or incest. And for an awful lot of people who are pro-choice, you can't be, as I say often, you can't be a little bit pregnant. So if you believe that it's okay to do abortions, then it doesn't matter whether it's a few number or a large number. It's the same. Here's the difference, though. If you have a man who says, I would like to see the number of abortions reduced, both through legislation and through, different practices, different education, things like that, at least you have somebody who's against it. Kate Brown is so firmly in the pocket of Planned Parenthood, she's going to make abortion as available as it possibly can be. So if you want a small distinction between the two, that would be one.
Yeah, I still struggle with it. You know, it's abortion is abortion. Even in the case of a rape situation, it's still not giving the child.
I would agree with you. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I got an email the other day about a subject that comes up from time to time and more often lately than a while ago, and it's called smart meters. It has to do with something that, on one level, I understand why the power companies want to do this. I understand why the government is pushing it. I also understand how it severely can affect your ability to make choices about how you use energy. So when Randall Barrett contacted us and said, hey, do you want to talk about smart meters? I said, sure, let's do it. Randall Barrett from R&D Innovations, LLC, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you, Art. Thanks for having me on the program.
So tell me about the program you have to try to let people have a voice in opposing the idea of imposing smart meters on the utility customers of the Northwest.
We just recently became aware of this problem and did some research, and we're shocked at the information we found. And most people are unaware of it. They feel like they have no voice. People are just caving in. They feel like they're under pressure. And the groups that are fighting it just don't seem to be able to win in many areas. They're working hard for our benefit, but it's just not working in many areas. So we started nosmartmeter.org for a specific purpose, to organize the groups around the country with protests and to give people a way to express their voice, to want to speak out. And people are loving it. They're like, yes, finally something we can do. And so people are just being squashed by the false information. They're being told it's less harmful than a cell phone. The studies are showing that these high-powered pulses coming off of these meters with these computers in them are 100 to 1,000 times more harmful because they're high-powered pulses, even though they're only for microseconds, and they go off 10,000 to 190,000 times a day. So it's a constant exposure. So children that are near them, people that have their offices near these, they're very harmful to their physiology. So people are shocked about that. But there's also other things. And we know that they end up charging people more because they no longer measure the meters. The meters don't measure accurately. They use algorithms, and they're hackable. And this is one of the ones that really scares me the most. People are very concerned when they start finding out that there's a computer that's being attached to their home, and they did not put a filter on it, a noise filter, a dirty voltage, dirty electricity filter. They left it off of those things. It's easy. Well, how did these engineers decide that it was okay to put this device on our home and not filter out dirty voltage? And this is scary because these computers can generate any kind of frequency they want across our wiring in our home and use our home wiring like an antenna. You know, you talk about censorship. I mean, this is scary stuff that's happening. So people need to know about the harm of this, but mostly even when they find out, they think they don't have a choice because it's like being extorted, it's like Nazi tactics. You don't, you know, do what they say.
Well, hold up. Let's not use the N-word. I don't call people Nazis unless they're mass murderers, and the power companies are not mass murderers. So don't get too excited on me because it just takes it into another realm. But let's start with this. Sure. Instead of, you know, the signals that are sent out by the meters, I understand your objection to that. I'm not necessarily sure that I agree with the technical side of that. But my biggest concern is that the power companies want to put these on because at some point they will say to the public, we need to be able to control what the devices, the electrical devices in your home are doing, mostly the air conditioning and the heating devices, so that they can control how much power you're using. Right now, the idea of having a meter so that you don't have to have a man or a woman drive around a neighborhood and physically look at meters to figure out what your consumption is, that seems pretty sensible to me. How the information gets transmitted, as you pointed out, can be problematic. But the idea of not having to drive around in a truck and check meters all day long seems sensible. It doesn't seem like it's something that you should have done by a person. It should be done by the ability to read that information remotely. But the part where it comes to saying, I'm going to turn your heat down in the winter or your air conditioning down in the summertime because the power company isn't producing enough power to avoid brownouts, that's my concern.
I'm more concerned about the hackability because people can easily hack into these bad actors. And by hacking in with that computer control, they can even melt down the device by overloading it, or they can up your power falsely, up your power usage, or they can turn your power off if they want to suppress your political views.
Offer my audience your proof that these devices are hackable from in some external location.
From actual proof, we have many sites that we reference on our website that have proof that these things are hackable.
No, I don't want a reference to that. Tell me where somebody has actually hacked a real existing smart meter You know, in other words, somebody sits at your curb with a computer and hacks into your meter. Why they'd want to do that, I don't know. If they want to set your house on fire, are they going to go through a complicated computer to hack into your meter and try to get it to overload the devices in your home? Or are they just going to strike a match and set your home on fire?
Well, obviously, this hasn't happened yet because these things are new. There are fires happening on these smart meters. We've had a few in the area recently. Gold Hill just had some burn up in the RV park there. They caught on fire and were sparking and exploding. So we know they can catch on fire. As far as hacking, we know they can be hacked. Will that be done? Well, bad actors do use many ways to get to us. So if they can get over our control of our computer that is attached to our house, and put any kind of frequency over our wiring that they use as an antenna in our home, that's scary. The kind of control that we're turning over to them. If you ask someone, do I want you to put a device on my home that has a computer in it, that you can take control of my home and do all these terrible things if bad actors get hold of it, people would say, no, of course I don't want that. And so they use the reasoning of the meter reading and other things to push it on you, but they don't disclose the other dangers. And I think that's a real serious concern.
So you'd be okay with the meters if they transmitted the information back to the power company, not using... And when you said microwaves, I really questioned that. My understanding was that they were not using microwaves, that they were actually transmitting the information back either over the power lines in a way that simply, you know, because all you're sending is ones and zeros and really a fairly small amount of information at that. Why would they have a microwave transmitter in a smart meter? And where do you find the evidence of that? Because I've never seen that evidence myself in all the reading I've done on smart meters.
You'll find the links on our site. What they're doing is they're using a microwave radiation pulse, similar to a cell phone, but a higher frequency and a much higher powered pulse. It's a short-term, high-powered pulse, and studies have shown that it's much more harmful on us. What they're doing is it's a grid. They bounce from your house to the next house to the next house until they can reach a cell tower. So that's the technology they're using that's pulsing out of these meters. So your information gets sent to your neighbor's meter, and the grid's not fully up yet, so they're not all pulsing at a high level yet, but they will. And so they go to the next meter and they keep collecting all your data until they can get to it.
Well, but how much of a pulse would it take to send information? Say your house is 100 feet from your neighbor's meter. How much? I mean, it doesn't take much energy to send a small message, ones and zeros, 100 feet.
Well, it's a micropulse. It's the level of the power. This is the thing that they're hiding. They try and average the total power and say it's a small amount. But the truth is, studies have shown that it's a very high-powered pulse, and it impacts the physiology much more, causing brain problems, thinking, headaches, heart palpitations, much more than cell phones. Like I said, studies 100 to 1,000 times more radiation exposure than a cell phone. So it's those concerns that people may not be aware of that easily can be tracked. On nosmartmeter.org, we have links to other sites that have done all the homework. There's tremendous ones. Even in British Columbia, there's so many sites that have done the homework and have scientists and engineers and whistleblowers who've got this information out there. So we just need to educate ourselves and then stand up together as a people. We need to make our voice known and fill the streets. And, yes, it's nice to get the fees reduced or removed, but we want these things removed from our country. Those are the citizens.
Hold on. You don't want to use them at all, even if they use a different method of sending the information back.
If they cannot receive a signal, if you could not get any kind of way that they could touch your home and some bad actor get control of it, and if the signal was sent out in a safe way, like you said, over the power wires in a non-harmful way, we would not be opposed to that. It's the fact that with the methodology they're doing and the things that they're hiding, this dirty voltage is very insidious.
Well, they can't be hiding it that effectively, Randall, or you wouldn't know about it, right?
They have meters right now that you can see the actual...
No. Listen to what I said. You say all this is hidden. You're an average person like me, right?
Yeah.
If it's hidden that effectively, how do you know about it?
Because there's engineers that are actually studying these and actually putting them on a oscilloscope.
So it's not hidden.
Well, it's not being publicized by the power companies or the PUC. It's not being made known to the people. They're being told that it's less exposure than a cell phone, which is not true.
Okay. Has your group gone to the Public Utility Commissions of Oregon or Washington or Idaho to bring this issue up yet?
Freedom to Say No to SmartMeters.org is a local group here in Jackson County that is going to the county commissioners. They have...
No, stop. The county commissioners don't control this. The public utility commissions of the three states are really in the driver's seat on things like this. That or the legislature. Have you gone to either one?
that Jackson County sent a letter to the PUC. So they are right now directly dealing with the PUC on this issue, yes. And there's a meeting tomorrow in Salem on this issue.
Very good. What's the website again?
NoSmartMeter.org.
Very good. We'll point people in that direction. Randall, thank you very much. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I wanted to mention this one story out of Spokane. Our friends at KXLY will know all about it. But the story is, and this is one of my theories about government, when government does not want you to do something, they will find every rule in the book to be able to stop you from doing something. When they want to do something or they want to make something happen, they will break all the rules in the book. And here's a good example. In most communities in the United States, here's the way it works. If you want to build a bunch of houses, you build the houses, you build the streets in front of the houses, the contractor does, and he gives the, you know, the cost is paid by the people who buy the houses. He does that one time, and then he deeds the streets over to the cities, and the cities take care of them from that point forward. But the original street or road has to be bought effectively by the homeowners. So every neighborhood pays for its own streets. Well, in Spokane, they apparently have quite a lot of streets that are not paved. I used to live there. I lived there a long time ago. They have 60 lane miles of unpaved roads in the city. One of them in particular is called Falls Avenue, and it has been unpaved, and apparently it turns into a mud pit in the middle of the wintertime. When melting snow comes down, that creates problems that are even bigger. And now, according to the Spokane spokesman, they're going to spend about $300,000 to pave a 900-foot stretch. Now, part of the problem is there are houses on that stretch of street. And you think, well, why aren't the homeowners paying for that? Apparently, on the opposite side of the street, there's land that's been put into conservation for nature and that sort of thing, which means nobody pays property taxes on it. It's owned by the government, so therefore, no taxes are collected from it. Ordinarily, you'd get the homes on both sides of the street to pay for that street. So what did the city do? They decided to take money charged on car tabs. It's a $20 per car tab increase that was put in place by the Spokane City Council about 6 or 7 years ago. It's generated $16 million in the past 6 years, and it was intended to pay for projects that improve safety and preserve the city's transportation system. That's the law. Then they come to Falls Avenue, and they say, but how are we going to pave this? Well, you should have it paid for the way you normally would pay for it, which is assign the cost to the homeowners. And if they want a paved street in front of their house, they need to pay for it the very first time. After that, it's the city's job. Instead, they're now apparently going to take $300,000, pave this street in violation of city law. Even the city, there's a public forum that is designed to look over these projects and decide which ones to do. They even said, we don't want you to do this. It says they have signed off on it despite a citizen oversight board determining that the project was not a proper use of funds. In other words, it violates the law to do it that way. And the city council is going to meet today to decide whether or not to go ahead and violate their own rules. And I guess what bothers me most about this, anytime the government wants something to happen, it doesn't mean anything that the law forbids it. They will go ahead and do it anyway. Let's go to Jim. Hey, Jim, you heard me sounding off on pagan Governor Kate Brown and her bid for re-election. What's your take?
Hey, Lars, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
Oregon native, just like yourself. I'm not one of these guys that just moved here 2 to 3 years ago and throws a keep weird Portland sticker on the bumper of their car. Born and raised, care about a lot of stuff. I'm a Democrat. I agree with about 90% of what you say. I'm voting for Newt. I hate Kate Brown. I'll use the word hate. She is ridiculous. But as far as her religious beliefs, who cares? I could care less. And I've heard you talk about this before. This is probably the only issue I really disagree with this, Lars, you, and abortion. And that's a whole other thing with Newt. He's never going to get elected if he comes out and says he's going to get abortion. You know that. So we've got to think here if you want a conservative governor, you've got to think, Lars, mayor, excuse me, you've got to think a little bit and let him go have that one issue. I know it's a humongous
issue. I'm letting him have it. I understood it, and I still back his candidacy. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying that if you ask me, do I agree with him on it, I'd say no. And that's all, just okay. So I'm clear, so that people aren't saying, well, you're backing Newton, he's pro-choice, so you're pro-choice too. No, I can disagree with people. What was it, Reagan, who said, is my 80% friend my 20% enemy? And the answer is no. You say, I agree with him on 80%, he's the right guy for the job. What I'm asking people is, when Kate Brown comes out and says, I'm not even sure God exists, is that a significant piece of information about that candidate? And I would say it is. I think it's significant to most Americans, whether you have religious beliefs or at least believe in God. And she apparently does not. And I was asking somewhat rhetorically, and when people said, well, Lars, is it important to you? I'd say, yeah, it tells me something about a person if they believe God does not exist. Because I personally believe, having read enough history about the Constitution, the rights in that Constitution are protected by the Constitution, but they don't come from the Constitution. They come from God. So they come from a source that Kate Brown believes does not exist. You get the last 10 seconds, quick.
Lars, would you be okay if she believed in Allah? Are you just mad because it's not your God?
No, that's God. She believes in, but she doesn't believe in any God, apparently.